Some of you were giving expression after that first hour to how odd opera seems to you. And let me just emphasize that it is. It's a very, very strange thing. I was saying that, you know, the first time you hear the human voice making those sounds, they're not sounds a human voice should make. It's not something we're used to hearing. It's very, very strange. So the sound itself is strange, and then you put it up there on a stage and have it going through a story, and the great 18th century critic, Dr. Samuel Johnson, said that opera is the most irrational of all the arts. And there's truth in that. I mean, there really is. It is, you're getting singers, you're getting the voice to do things it doesn't normally do. You're singing a whole play. This is peculiar stuff. This is really strange. And yet at the same time, we also know there is a way in which at the time, at intense moments, one turns to song. That is, music gives expression to things that are beyond the everyday. Always. And again, you can see, I could draw for you, I won't take the time, the way in which, again, the Mass led to opera. I made the claim earlier that all Western music, as we know it, grows out of chant, grows out of the Mass. And in that sense, opera does as well. And the fact of the matter is, there are times when the singers in the Mass are making sounds that are not sounds you would be used to anywhere else. Now, there is something peculiar. There's something very peculiar, again, in having people up on the stage. Yes, I wasn't being critical. Yeah. I was thinking of the best case scenario. Yes. But I'll just tell one story. The other problem, of course, is you have very well-trained voices. You don't necessarily have musicians. Luciano Pavarotti cannot read music. Okay? One of the great singers in the world today, he cannot read music. He learns to sing phrase by phrase from a coach who teaches him how to sing. He cannot sit down and read music. Very often these singers are not the brightest people in the world. You get them up on stage and strange things can happen. I'll just share one story. I could take up the whole hour with stories, but I'll just give you one. This is a true story. This is my favorite opera story. This actually occurred during a performance of Tosca. Act two of Tosca, the evil villain Scarpia, who is a magistrate in Rome, is trying to seduce the actress Tosca. She's in love with a young painter. The painter's been arrested and is being tortured, and Scarpia says, "All right, I will free him and let you flee with him if you yield yourself up to me." And she says, "Oh, I'll do it, all right, I'll do it." And so he signs the release for them, and then turns on her and says, "Tosca, finalmente mia, at last you are mine." And while he's been signing the release, she has gone over to this little supper table that's been set up for him. And he comes to embrace her, and she grabs a knife off the table and says, "Questo è il bacio di Tosca. This is the kiss of Tosca." And plunges the knife into his chest, and he dies in agony, and she's over. It's a great ending to the second act. It's fiery stuff, okay? True story, actual performance. And they're singing, and the Scarpia goes to sign the thing, and the Tosca backs up to the supper table, and the prop people have forgot to set the silverware. The knife is not there. And the next thing, the Scarpia is coming at the Tosca singing, "Tosca, finalmente mia," and the soprano grabbed a banana from the fruit bowl and plunged the banana into his chest, saying, "This is the kiss of Tosca," and the Scarpia stood there with mashed banana right now, as the audience screamed with laughter. It's one of those, you would have paid any amount of money to be there for that. It's live performance. I mean, again, opera's theater in that sense. It's you never know what's going to happen. I've been talking about the change in the character of Desdemona. I want to get to some musical examples, so I'm going to run through this a little more quickly than I had hoped. Let me talk about the change in the nature of Iago. As I said, in the opera we see Iago simply beginning his machinations immediately. He is out to get Cassio. He's going to get Cassio drunk. He's going to destroy Othello. He hates Othello. He says it directly. I mentioned when I spoke about the play that critics have spoken about the nature of evil presented by Shakespeare, that the Iago in the play can basically be summed up as a motiveless malignancy. He is an evil without a motive. One thing that makes him so frightening is we don't know really why he's doing all this. He is simply there doing it. And it is difficult to go back to a core reason, and for that reason, he is more disturbing to us. It's not a matter of here's what he's doing, here's why he's doing it. We don't have that. In the opera, Boito goes out of his way and gives us a moment where Iago speaks quite openly as to what he is doing and why, and it opens the second act of the opera. I'm just going to read it to you. It turns into a great moment for the bass baritone in the opera. It's a grand piece of music as he gives voice to his evil nature. But more than that, he's giving very specific reasons why he is doing what he is doing. I'm reading an English translation. The Italian begins, credo in un Dio crudel. We get a demonic credo, okay? This is Italian. The composer and librettist know what they're playing off of. And of course, this demonic credo will then be contrasted in Act 4 with the angelic Ave Maria sung by Desdemona, okay? So we get the evil devil and the good angel. And it's done in very stark terms, which is something we do not have in the play. Not in that clear-cut way. I believe in a cruel God who created me in his image and who in fury I name. There is a hint of 19th century Calvinism there. God is cruel, he's created us just to destroy us, and I'm angry with him. We are going to very soon come upon another 19th century work in this same vein where this dominates the whole work, okay? We'll get to that tomorrow. From the very vileness of a germ or an atom, vile was I born. The germ that made me was vile, therefore I'm vile. Nature itself is corrupt, therefore I am corrupt. I am a wretch because I am a man. All men are fallen. All of nature is fallen. Therefore I'm fallen. I'm like everybody else. And I feel within me the primeval slime. Okay, this is written post-Darwin. It's all just sort of it's a big primeval slime and ooze out there. And man was created as the result of a kind of accident and bleh. Yes, this is my creed. I believe with a heart as steadfast as that of the widow in church. And the evil I think and that which I perform, I think and do by destiny's decree. Not my fault. I'm fated to be evil. I was born evil, therefore I have to act evil. I believe the just man to be a mocking actor in face and heart. No such thing as justice. It's just pretense. There's no good in the world, there's just pretense. That all his being is a lie. Tear, kiss, glance, sacrifice, and honor. That's all lies. There's nothing good, upright, noble. And I believe man the sport of evil fate from the germ of the cradle to the worm of the grave. We begin in the germ, we go to the worm, that's all there is. And it's all a joke. After all this mockery, then comes death. And then, death is nothingness, heaven an old wives' tale. There's no afterlife. This is very modern. We begin with the vision of a cruel God who's created a cruel world in which all men are fallen, all men are basically damned, all men are vile. But then he goes a step forward and we get late 19th century nihilism. But it's not a matter of after I'm dead I'll be sent to hell or heaven, because there's nothing. Death is oblivion. Death is nothingness. There's no meaning to anything. Therefore, I'm evil. This is not the Iago of Shakespeare at all. If you'll remember, Iago in the play in the first act speaks about what defines man, and he says man is reasonable. Man possesses reason. And reason is given man to control his appetites, basically his lusts. What he leaves out is the heart. And what we have here is this curious, again, I would almost call, this is intellectually contradictory. nor are you meant to look at it or reason through it. What carries you along, as Iago gives his creed, is the music. Until finally it moves toward that moment of la morte è nulla. Death is nothing. There's just nothingness. Okay? And it is a powerful musical moment. There's just nothingness. Therefore, he will reduce everything to death. But it is not thought out. It is not analytical. My point. We get a demonic figure who is just pure evil, who believes in nothing, who stands for nothing, and will simply destroy. We have the Desdemona, who is angelic, and just after this, remember, comes the moment where she's in the garden and the children are bringing her gifts and the ladies are singing and the mandolin is playing. I mean, she is enshrined at that moment, in wearing the white. I mean, it's a gorgeous moment, absolutely gorgeous. But what we have again is this woman who is transcendently beautiful. She is angelic. She's never done anything wrong. Why should she be punished? And what we have is Otello in between, who's very heroic, and he's got the beautiful wife on one side and this evil man on the other side, and we hope he won't listen to the evil man, but he does, and therefore he falls and kills his wife. It's that simple. It's that simple. And the point I'm making is the play is not that simple. There's an intellectual substructure to the play. What the opera is doing is stirring us emotionally, and it can do it because everything is designed, if you will, in broader strokes. The colors are brighter. The whites are very white. The black is very black. We have the struggle in the middle. And as a result, it goes right to the heart. The music is brilliantly designed, goes right to the heart, and we get the story. But it is a different story. It comes down to this. Let me summarize it in basically one phrase. The difference between Shakespeare's Othello and Verdi's Otello is that Shakespeare believes in original sin. Othello is a deeply complex work about human nature because it tells hard truths. Othello is a magnificent operatic presentation of the story, but it is an opera rooted in liberal romanticism. 19th century liberalism, 19th century romanticism. It plays to the emotion, it works on the emotions, and it denies original sin. What do I mean by that? We see it most evidently in Desdemona, who is not responsible. She is not tainted in any way. She is not touched in any way. And we see it in the Iago, who is just bad. He's just evil, but he is so evidently evil, his nature is so twisted, that we could almost imagine, if only this man had gone to counseling. What Verdi's Iago needs is a good therapist. And the reason is, he can state very directly why he's the way he is. Here's reason one, here's reason two, here's reason three. And the therapist would say, well, you have some very strange ideas. Let's talk through this. Lie down on the couch. Let's see how far back it goes. You could not put Shakespeare's Iago on a couch. You don't even know where to begin with that figure. It is so much a part of his very nature, and he gives no clues. We get very little sense of where is this coming from? Why is it happening? And it's clear, as with all the other characters, his nature is touched with original sin in a particularly frightening way. But then so is Othello, so is Desdemona, so is Rodrigo. It is a vision, and it's not the liberal vision of a fallen world, it's all just awful. Because the characters in Shakespeare have tensions going back and forth. Desdemona may have made a wrong choice, but we still admire her, she's an interesting woman. Othello may fall, but he is still possessed of great nobility. Iago may be very evil, but there's something about him that is extremely attractive. Verdi's Iago never makes us laugh. And that whole point of the comic side of Shakespeare's Iago is gone in the opera. There's nothing amusing about it. We don't smile at him. He's just mean. He's bad. He's in the need of counseling. And again, that is the liberal act. This could be fixed. It's a shame. It's just a shame that he didn't have good counseling when he was young or a social worker around him to take care of this problem. And if it really is that bad, then he should be removed from society and just locked up somewhere, and then society would be fine. And the vision is you get rid of Iago, everything's fine. You remove Iago from Shakespeare, you still have problems. You've got big problems. You remove Iago from Verdi, and you've got a nice world. You've got a happy couple, and you've got, you know, and then you have a happy ending. And the nice hero gets his angel, and, you know, then we have a happy story. That's 19th century liberalism. What is liberalism? It's the denial of original sin. And this work denies original sin. Now, I am being harsh on the work, intellectually. I love it. I love this piece. The reason I love it is because of the music. And there are things that the music can do that are extraordinary, because Verdi can still give us truths about the human heart. He can understand the nature of something that is angelic and turn it into music. He can give us heroism in music. It's there. I'm just going to take a couple of moments from the opera and look at things that the opera can do that the play couldn't. Okay? I've been critical in one sense of the intellectual structure. Let me look at something, possibilities that the opera creates. And the way in which Verdi, master composer, is able to use these moments and create something quite extraordinary. I want to start with the entrance of Otello. Very beginning. We have the storm at Cyprus. They don't know if the ships are going to come in. The people kneel and say the prayer. And then indeed Otello arrives. He walks on and sings one line, one phrase, which basically says, "Rejoice, because the Turks have sunk to the bottom of the sea. The victory is ours and God's," he says. Okay? And now let us give thanks. That's basically it. That's all that's it. This single line is the reason most tenors can't sing this part. It starts right here. The poor tenor has to walk out on stage and sing. It's 15 seconds of music. It is so deadly difficult that many singers just don't even go near it. It is set at the worst possible place of the tenor range. Why did Verdi do this? Was he being mean to tenors? No, what he wants is that sense of heroic exaltation. He wants some strain on the tenor's part so that you hear him going for these notes. We get in the vocal line the struggle that has just occurred, and a great tenor who can come out and get through it, he then lets go off stage and collapse and get some rest before he has to come back out and sing again. But the battle's going on in the vocal line, okay? I'm going to play it once, then I'm going to play it on the piano for you and talk about the shape of the line itself. Because what the poetry is doing in Shakespeare's play, the shape of the melody is doing in the opera. Just listen once, okay? Otello's entrance. Orchestra. I mean, he's singing. This is his entrance, okay? He's been warming up in the dressing room for 2 hours, just trying to get the voice up there. Then he comes down, he's got to sing over the whole orchestra, okay? And let me play the line for you. This is just killing. This is just murderous. This is just the vocal part, okay? Hear that leap? The first thing that the Otello does, walks out and the voice has to take this leap upward. Deliberate. Our hero comes out and we start on a very easy, nice little note that he can sing quite comfortably. Da 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 da, we can all do that, okay? And then there is a heroic leap. Okay? And then up. Now we get a little rest. And then we take another leap. It's a G sharp. Oh, oh, oh. We come back down. The line falls back down. It's been up there, it falls back down. And then we go up again. Now we're staying up in this range. Killing for the tenor. It's what's called in the voice where the break comes. It's where the break in the tenor voice occurs and you're going from one register to the other, and it's the place you do not want to sing, much less bellow over a full orchestra, okay? Then we go up higher. It's an A natural. For a tenor, I mean, he's already half dead, he comes out, oh, now he's got to hit the A natural and hold it. B natural. We come to rest on an E natural, and he goes off and collapses. Okay? What have we got? We've got heroic leaps that then climb, that fall back. We leap again. We leap up higher. He stays up there, goes up to the B natural, holds it up there, whoom, off. It's a heroic melody line. It's heroic on the part of the singer to get through it. And indeed, this is what happens with opera fans. Those people in the top gallery at La Scala, if a tenor comes out to do it, had better nail every one of those notes. If he doesn't, as he goes off, they're hooting and throwing things at him, okay? Now, I'm jumping ahead to the opening of Act 4. And what we have here, Act 4 opens, by the way, there is a major cut in the film. And I'm not sure why Zeffirelli did it. But the cut in the film has to do with, he cuts the Willow Song and just gives us the Ave Maria. The sequence in the opera is about 17, 18 minutes long. Desdemona sings the Willow Song as she does in the play, remembering the maid that her mother had named Barbara, the song that the maid sang when her love was false to her, sings the Willow Song, Emilia leaves, and then in the opera, Desdemona sings the Ave Maria. It's a long sequence, but what Verdi is doing, and it's part of the angelic presentation of this woman, a secular song that moves to the sacred Ave Maria. So that right before she is killed, right before Othello's entrance into the bedchamber, she has quite literally been elevated once again to angelic heights. The last thing she sings before she goes to bed is the Ave Maria. Okay? And he is indeed, once again, the purity of an angel. The purity of an angel, okay? Just a curiosity here. I'm playing for you the opening of Act 4, which gives us the theme of the Willow Song on English horn. What have we got? A similar leap. We have the same leap upward. The music, has been changed enough. It's turned into the Willow Song. But we have Verdi taking the same shape of the melodic line for Desdemona's Willow Song as we had with the heroic entrance of Otello. What's he doing? He's linking the two characters musically. They are sharing something of the same, of the same melodic line. He is using the same musical materials. He is, if you will, marrying the two together. But we have gone from the heroic entrance of the hero to this heartbreaking song that will be sung by the heroine. One more time. She's up there only briefly, and then notice what happens. The line sinks down. The line sinks down. It's absolutely gorgeous musically. Gorgeous musically. One other thing I wonder, I don't have the time, I'm not going to play this on the recording, but I'm going to the very end of the Ave Maria, which is a beautiful piece of music. She finishes praying Nel Ora della Morte and then sings an Amen. It's a simple major chord. Sings a simple major chord. And then, in all humility, a final Amen, low in the register. And as she gets into her bed, the violins are at the very top of their range, okay? Okay, we're up at the very next sound you hear. He has the violins playing at the very top of the range. The next note comes in on the bass. It is, I swear, it's the gap between heaven and hell. The violins have been playing at the top of their range. The basses come in playing at the very bottom of their range. We've gone from the top of the highest string instrument to the lowest note on the double bass. It's a haunting effect. And the chasm in between gives us that sense, musically, of what now separates husband and wife. What's happened? He has given in to his lower nature, and boom, it descends. And those double basses play all the time that he's moving around the bed. And what we're still hearing is that the high violin tremolos that ended her Ave Maria. Gorgeous stuff. It's gorgeous stuff. There are a couple of things I do want to play. Since I'm at the piano, I'll do this one first. I need to get the page number on this. There's something else that opera can do very well. Here's something Shakespeare couldn't do if he wanted to. And it's the reason that opera is something in and of itself. Remember the scene in the Olivier when the ambassadors come from Venice and they give the letters to Othello. And as he's reading through the letters, he's making side remarks to Desdemona. He's commenting to the ambassador. He's trying to put on a nice face for the ambassadors. We see this beast in him coming out. He's talking to Desdemona. And finally, he strikes her with the letter. The focus in that scene is on Olivier, is on Othello. The focus in the opera moves to Desdemona. It's interesting, Father Doran caught this in viewing it last night. He doesn't just slap her with the letter. He hurls her to the ground. There is a physical action. He lashes out at her and hurls her to the ground and sings to her, "Fall to the ground and weep." Okay? So the focus goes away from the hero again to the victim. Victim's rights, victim's rights. I'm mocking this, but 100 years later, soon they'll be picketing this. It's an abusive husband. They really shouldn't allow this to be shown. Othello needs counseling too. Desdemona should phone the wife abuse hotline. And we can take care of these problems. We can solve these problems. He hurls her to the ground, and then she begins by singing an extraordinary, I'm going to play this whole moment, an extraordinary moment. And suddenly we have every character on stage giving voice to a different emotion, while the chorus is split, the men's chorus and the women's chorus singing different emotions, we have a septet with double chorus. And it is all happening simultaneously. Shakespeare on stage has to focus on one character. Verdi at this moment can open up panoramically and have seven different characters. We've got Othello, Desdemona, Iago, Rodrigo, Emilia, Cassio, Lodovico, the ambassador from Venice, all singing at once. I don't have the time to go through, but let me just say each vocal line is individual, created and shaped according to the particular character. We put them all together, we have a septet, seven voices singing at once. And then, as if that's not enough, he adds the double chorus behind it and full orchestra. And you have suddenly a moment when time stops and emotionally we're getting the sense of the enormous impact this single event is having on all these characters. And it's given with a kind of simultaneity that's impossible on the stage. Only music can do it for us, okay? I'm going to start right at that moment. I just need to get the band number here. Emilia starts... Well, I'm going to start with the Desdemona's moment. Othello says, to the ground and weep. And she says, yes, I'll fall to the ground, but I don't know what I've done to deserve this. And then it turns into the full ensemble. Desdemona gets about 2 minutes on her own. And then the full ensemble comes in. Track 12. This is about 6 minutes of music. Open your ears wide. It's glorious stuff. Desdemona first. Tears. Thank you. notice what happens. We want it to end. We want an ending. We want a set piece. We want the septet with double chorus to end. Instead, and this is Wagnerian, Otello breaks in. Otello breaks in, and suddenly musically we're off somewhere else. That's what I meant by through composed. The piece does not come to that resting point. We're ready for it to stop. Instead, right on. The Otello steps. One thing I must say, and I do mean in saying that the music is appealing to the emotions. This is a romantic work, but you have an old master here through his art and his extreme craftsmanship is holding it in check. He's letting it out sometime, he's pulling in. Technically, the mastery is superb. The music, the more you get to know it, there is so much to listen to. Is just extraordinarily designed. I make the claim, and I do mean it, that popular music, so-called popular music, is misnamed because it is not popular. It lasts 3 months, 3 years, it's gone. Because it's been used up. You listen to it a few times, first couple times you hear it, you like it, third, fourth, fifth time, it's pretty good, sixth, seventh, it's okay. 10th, 12th listening, I want something new. I need something new. The greatness of what I would call serious music is that it's really popular. It lasts over time. The more you listen to it, the more it rewards you. It keeps giving. There does not come the point where you're saying, oh, my ears are tired of that, I'm bored with that. Can't happen. It just keeps rewarding. And it's because of the design, the vision, and the technical skill of the composer. Okay. Now it's time for. I was talking earlier. I forgot the gentleman's name who plays the violin in the quartet. Okay. Yeah, I was talking to Kevin. I was talking to Kevin after he was telling me about every Saturday afternoon. When he was growing up, his father would listen to the Met Opera broadcast every Saturday afternoon, and we had a wonderful moment because I grew up on the Met broadcast as well. Every Saturday afternoon, in front of that radio, to listen to live from the Met, brought to you by Texaco. I still put Texaco gas in my car. I'm indebted to these people. It's the longest sponsorship in radio or television history. They've been sponsoring this thing for over 50 years. Bless them. And every Saturday afternoon, you can hear a live opera from the Met when the Met's in season. Well, one of the fun parts of it is opera intermissions are long. 25, 30 minutes, because the singers, they're athletes. They've got to go back and collapse and rest and, you know, water the throat and all of this before they can go out for another round. So they have these intermission features. Well, always after the second act, what you get is the opera quiz. And it's wonderful fun. You get these pompous old folks on and the hot shots and you get to send in questions, and if they choose your question, you win some opera recordings. It's thrilling. What can I say? So here's today's opera quiz. Before we wrap this up, here's today's opera quiz. I'm at the moment right before that septet begins. I'm at the moment when Otello throws Desdemona to the ground. I am looking at the single phrase, a terra e piangi. Okay? That's all he sings. It's six notes. 1887, tell me where this phrase occurs after 1887. There is another composer coming along who tips his hat to Verdi and turns this into one of the most famous melodies in all opera. This is an opera quiz. All I'm going to play for you is Otello's vocal line, okay? And the winner is? Leoncavallo, yes. What's the opera? Paiacci. Got it? Ridi Paiacciam, la da da dum da da dum ya dum ba bum. Now, what's the point of the little game? The point is a couple of things. One, we have again the whole purpose of tradition. What do we know? We know that Leoncavallo pored over Verdi's score. He obviously knew it to the point. This is a little throwaway phrase in the Verdi. It's a throwaway phrase. It's nothing. But Leoncavallo is writing a work about a husband who thinks he's been betrayed by his wife. He has been betrayed by his wife. He is about to go out into a public situation in which he's going to face her, and he's got to put on a face for the public. He's putting on a clown face and saying, laugh, clown, even though you're crying inside. We have a parallel drama, a drama of betrayal by a wife. In Otello, it's not for real. In Paiacci, it's real. Netta has indeed committed adultery. She has betrayed her husband. It will end with the killing of the wife. And in the same way, it comes to crisis in a public moment when the husband's going to turn on the wife in public. Leoncavallo says what? I've got to go back to my Verdi. I've got to go back to my Verdi. Studies the score, comes to the big moment, takes the little melody. A terra e piangi. God bless you, Verdi, he says, and tips his hat, takes that little phrase, turns it into one of the most famous arias in Italian opera. But what we're working with is tradition, an artistic tradition in which one artist will build on what another artist has given him and create something entirely new. A throwaway moment in Verdi becomes one of the most famous arias in all of Italian opera. You're the winner. And the winner of this week's quiz. Good. Okay, I'm going to do one last thing here. One last thing. Again, talking about the differences between the play and the opera and what opera can do. I'm looking specifically at the moment that ends Act 3, Scene 3 of the play, and comes at the end of the second act of the opera, and it's what I call the mystical marriage between Othello and Iago. I made the point that in the play, what we have at that moment is a kind of horrible inevitability, because we have fragmented human beings with partial visions of love, neither one complete, neither one fully correct, that have to come together and be united in some way. Othello is attempting to claim that the love he feels for Desdemona is pure, ideal, spiritual, does not partake of the flesh. Iago is claiming there is only fleshly lust. There's nothing high, there's nothing ideal, there is only appetite. It is true that we are creatures of flesh and blood, we have bodies, husband and wife become one flesh. Othello's denying that. It is true that from that comes a spiritual union that reflects a divine love, and can be made to manifest that love through the creative act and in ultimately move the married couple toward a glimpse of something higher, something spiritual, something divine. Iago's denying that. In the Shakespeare play, the two men come together, and when they come together, we have a completeness. There's a kind of completeness, all right? Now, Verdi takes that as the opportunity, even though he's not dealing with the same ideas. Okay? We don't have that same kind of setup here, but what we do have, I'll just go through it quickly, is two different figures coming together, different points of view, where we get again the union of the hero and the villain. I have to discuss it in standard operatic terms. We have this conjunction of hero and villain, and they're singing together. We get, in one sense, a standard operatic duet between tenor and bass baritone, which you have in every opera that Verdi ever wrote, but it is transformed now and made into something that is increasingly dramatic, that is there to serve the drama. And what we have is Iago, essentially, in this union with Othello, breaking him away from his angelic wife, breaking that bond and winning him over to the dark side. I don't have time to go through the vocal line, but as you listen to it, we start out with Othello singing, now by yon marble heaven, by the jagged lightning flash, by death and by the dark death-dealing ocean flood, in fury and dire compulsion shall thunderbolt soon rain from this hand that I raise outstretched. There will be justice, and it will be severe justice. He starts to rise. Iago prevents him, kneels next to him. Do not rise yet. Witness you, sun that I gaze on, which lights me and animates the broad earth and the spiritual expanse of the whole universe, that to Othello I consecrate ardently heart, hands, and soul, even though on bloody business his will be bent. They sing together. And what we get is the two voices coming together, standard operatic duet, the duet transformed, however, into something that is fundamentally dramatic, but again, it's something Shakespeare couldn't do. He could not have the two men suddenly speaking simultaneously. You'd get gibberish. You wouldn't know who to listen to. Part of the glory of opera is Verdi can do precisely that. The two men sing together. Please listen to the moments when Iago's vocal line, even though he has the lower voice, is dominating the tenor. Okay? And again, what you have, and this is what a great operatic composer does, not just the shape of the line, but in a duet, in a trio, where is the vocal line moving? How does it relate to the other vocal line? And in that, he is creating extraordinary drama. We'll end with a good rousing tenor bass baritone duet. And I'm doing it again, trying to show, in spite of my criticisms, there is something very great in the opera that can't be matched in the play. Okay. This is the very end of Act Two of the opera. Hit the final chord, and then comes that eerie modulation where everything just sinks down. That's nicely done. That's good stuff. It's very interesting. I hadn't listened to this recording for a while. The poor bass baritone cannot keep up with old leather lungs. Mario Delmonico, the tenor, is just bellowing and drowning out the bass baritone there, something fierce. I can see the poor recording engineers trying to balance the two. It's impossible. Delmonico was one of those who sang this role a lot. Great Italian tenor, but was one of those who apparently, He had a throat of iron and lungs of leather and could just go out there and bellow his head off, which is not necessarily artistic, but thrilling to hear him on stage because he could actually get through this. Pavarotti never sang this other than once with the Chicago Symphony in a concert performance. Did it once in Chicago, once in London. That was it. They recorded it, made a fortune off it. Opera companies offered to pay him anything to go on stage and do it. And he said, are you crazy? Forget it. He said, I made it through two performances. That's it. That's it. It's a killer. Although Verdi was kinder to the tenor as Otello than Wagner was to poor Tristan. The original Tristan died 6 weeks after the premiere. I mentioned earlier there's the famous night at the Met, the night of the three Tristans. The scheduled Tristan made it through Act One, went to his dressing room, collapsed, said, I can't go on. They took him to the hospital. They brought out the understudy, the cover they had there, who went out and sang the second act, collapsed, was hauled off. And then they delayed the performance while they went around the city of New York and found an old guy who knew Tristan, had sung it years ago, who agreed to come in and sing Act Three, which is the most difficult. It opens with about a 45-minute monologue for Tristan singing alone as he's dying. But this old guy got through Act Three, front page of the New York Times the next morning, the night of the three Tristans at the Met. But part of what's going on here, and what you have with both Wagner and Verdi, is pushing human capacity to the extremes. There's a sense, the vision, the romantic vision is an extreme vision, and it made extreme demands on the vocalists. Mozart made no such demands. And in fact, singers say that once you've sung some Verdi and Wagner, you better spend some time singing Mozart, because Mozart will quite literally heal the voice. It will put the voice back in order. It is balanced. It is not at the extremes of the range. It forces clarity, shape, and it is it's everything that one would expect from the classical period, as opposed to this, which is the apotheosis of 19th century romanticism. We will get another 19th century romantic tomorrow, but with an intellectual and extraordinarily dark vision.